This panel is going to be kind of fun. If you ask some questions that pop up, we ask you to text them to 573-821-1172, or you can tweet with the NBB11 hashtag that you'll see on the screen. So if you've got a question, bring it up. They'll kind of sort them out, and later on in the program, they'll bring them to us. So good morning, guys.
Good morning. Good morning.
We have any news in the back room? I think most of the crowd would have enjoyed our back room discussion. It was kind of good.
I think so.
We've had a lot of water go over the dam since we last did this in Dallas. We've seen a lot of new things come and go. We had a pretty good time in Dallas, so we anticipate a good one this morning. A year ago, this audience, and matter of fact, the panel was kind of down. The markets were pretty bad. We had the loss of the dollar blending credit. Today, we're sitting here with a one-year extension. You know, we've got a positive court ruling for our biodiesel industry, although the lawyers always seem to be able to churn through something new. We've got a little bit of appeal going on that. Sorry, are you surprised with all the good news? You know, does that surprise this panel? And what have you learned over the last year? Any hard-learned wisdom you want to share? And just start with whoever wants to start up.
Well, I think from our perspective, Ron, in the midstream sector, in other words, pipelines and terminals, what we learned was that the lapse of the credit certainly has an impact on enthusiasm towards investments. And as we look towards investing in future terminal infrastructure, and by that I mean new storage and new lines to the rack and blending systems, a lot of those systems are over $2 million to install. So our shippers and position holders that lease space from us at terminals look for certainty, and we look to them to underpin our investments. So last year was a year of uncertainty, and now we have a little bit more fixed dynamics to deal with for the rest of this year.
Did you see a lot different biodiesel volumes going through your terminals last year, Bruce?
Well, the volumes that we have, Ron, in many cases are driven by state mandates or tax credits, combination of the two. So a lot of the infrastructure that we've invested in is up in the northern tier of the country in Minnesota and North Dakota and in northern Iowa. And there's a mandate in Minnesota which drives a lot of that volume. And that mandate was changed a little bit during the wintertime last year. But diesel demand was up on our system last year. We're projecting another healthy year of diesel fuel growth this year. So we're looking forward to a good year with biodiesel.
Mike and John, you both trade a little RINs and a little product. What were you seeing in past year, and what are you seeing today?
Well, I think, Ron, you know, last year from a trading desk vantage point, it was a bit of a character building year, but we had a good finish in December, and I think, you know, the market needed the clarity it's received, and so we're real optimistic about the upcoming year, and it looks positive.
I think this year for a lot of the biodiesel traders, it was a year of learning how to manage risk. And probably more importantly, how to explain the risk to your management and your owners. It was definitely a character building exercise, and we thought all along that we were going to get the credit. We weren't really surprised. I guess we were surprised at the timing. You know, we were hoping that we would get it sooner to spur on some investment and more volume, you know, towards the second half of last year. But we're very optimistic about this year in the coming years for biodiesel.
Well, right now it seems like a lot of things have lined up for the biodiesel industry. It's kind of appears to be ready for another takeoff again. But talking to other producers, some have been pretty good, business has perked up for them lately. Some it's been pretty slow. So what are you guys seeing currently? Is it perky? You know,
I'll jump in, Ron. You know, one of the things we're looking at is, you know, last year was a tough year to take up any opportunities to build our infrastructure. And right now, we do have some projects that have been engineered. We're looking at saying how can we take these to the next level now and get those implemented. So now that the dollar's here and the credits are here, looking at it, it makes sense for us to look at our infrastructure again and take some of these projects that we have 63 terminals, only four right now are biodiesel capable. And so when we look at that, you know, we're saying, how do we go to that next step? So we're looking at some major projects to try to take biodiesel into our inventories and be able to sell that out with our distillates.
So what were those numbers? You have 63?
63 terminals.
And you have four with biodiesel?
Yes.
How are you going to allocate your capital to the other 59? Have you figured that out?
Yes, and some of the things we already have engineered, we've looked at. One of the things we're trying to do with that is, where can we put infrastructure in that we can handle multiple facilities? What I mean by that is one infrastructure that I can handle that can supply 5, 6, 7 type terminals. So whether it's on a pipeline system or it's on a barge loading facility where we can put the product on the river and then hit multiple terminals where we supply, those are things we're looking at. So we make one investment and be able to cover multiple facilities to do that. So.
Any other comments from any of you gentlemen?
We've got a system of over 8,000 miles of pipeline and 60 terminals, and I'm the only non-obligated party here, and our whole idea is these are our customers. We're looking for them to provide guidance with their strategy and how they're going to go ahead and do more blending. Last year, we announced a couple of pretty aggressive projects. We've seen a lot more interest at the start of this year in going ahead and make those work. We will be kicking off. We have commitments for down in Florida, the Orlando market. We'll be kicking that off mid-year. We have full commitments on that. And we'll be coming back to put larger volumes. We have very small volumes on our large plantation pipeline from Mississippi to North Carolina. And we're coming back out with that in March. And we'll go ahead and test the markets then to see how much more positive they are.
Well, both of our pipeline people operate common carrier pipelines, so you respond to your supplier and customers' demands. We've talked as an industry for quite a few years, or at least several months, about piping biodiesel. So are your customers, suppliers starting to ask more about piping biodiesel, or where are you at in that whole process?
You're right, Ron. And there is interest in the transportation of biodiesel blends via pipeline. There has been for quite some time. And we've actually done a test over the last couple of years on a small segment of our pipe from Houston to a terminal in the northern part of Houston, and everything went fine. So from a technical standpoint, we know it's possible. But there are some challenges and barriers in place which really prohibit current large-scale transportation of biodiesel blends via pipe. And a lot of that deals with jet fuel. And the audience may be aware that there's a trailback issue. In other words, the ability of biodiesel to trail back into products or move through the pipeline into adjoining products. So if you have a biodiesel blend, for example, and then it's followed by a batch of jet fuel, there's nothing in between that separates those two. There's no physical barrier. Those two products are butted up against one another. So the biodiesel blend may leave trace levels of biodiesel in the jet fuel. And currently, within ASTM, that's not permissible. In other words, there's not a small de minimis level of biodiesel that's available or allowable in jet fuel. So that's a big issue for pipeline operators, because we're a publicly traded company. Every product that leaves our rack into a truck which goes to a service station or a truck stop is going to be on spec. And so we cannot allow jet fuel to go into airports via pipeline or by truck if there's trace levels of biodiesel currently in it. So that's why we have a prohibition. That's the main driver why there's a current prohibition, unless there's a line that we have that doesn't deliver jet fuel. So that's the major issue currently of why there's not widespread transportation of biodiesel via pipeline. I know there's efforts underway, testing, looking at turbine engines and possible revisions within ASTM to deal with that over time, but that's a major issue. We're getting interest in the transportation of renewable diesel as well. Longer term, the pipeline transportation inevitably is the lowest cost transportation option available if you move a large volume of any liquid commodity. So, and it's the safest way and the most reliable way. So, but for the interim, we're convinced that terminal blending operations, installing segregated storage, systems at the rack with ratio-type blending systems, and as I mentioned earlier, that investment is between $2 and $2.5 million per terminal for us. So that's where we're focused. There are other opportunities to explore, as Dave had mentioned earlier, about putting biodiesel blends in a pipe and serving various terminals. All companies are going to be looking at those types of things. But as you look at your overall costs, it may be just as efficient to install blending systems at the terminal. So we're looking at a lot of those things as well within Magellan. And we have the nation's longest refined products pipeline, so if we can figure out how to move products in the pipeline, it's to our interest to do that. But we're focused on terminal blending of biodiesel for the moment.
How many terminals do you have? How many?
We have 85 in 22 states, and roughly a dozen of those have biodiesel blending infrastructure.
And again, most of those are in the Midwest.
Most of the, yeah, the furthest one west is in Denver, and the furthest one east is in New Haven, Connecticut. But the majority of our investment is in the Midwest.
And to echo Bruce's sentiments on the trail back, it's a key issue. We're very fortunate in some of our systems. We have been moving biodiesel blends on our two pipeline systems, our Portland to Eugene in Oregon, and we've been moving it on our plantation pipeline weekly since mid-2009. And that's what we're able to scale up. When you find a pipeline system that allows you not to put it on at the same, say inside the same pipeline that jet fuel is, you then can exploit that and go ahead and move much larger volumes. So if those are available, you go ahead and do it. We have that ability from, like I said, Mississippi to Greensboro, North Carolina. We move that in small volumes now. We hope to go ahead and increase that by almost a multiple of 10, the capacity that we can move on that.
Well, since we got kind of a flip here, we got a little infrastructure and question and the ability to blend biodiesel. And, of course, when you blend biodiesel, that gives you the ability to separate a RIN. With the finalization of the RFS2 volumes, and this is kind of a hybrid question here, do you see the role of and this kind of goes to Bruce's area too. Most of his terminal blending is in the upper Midwest. But do you see the finalization of the RFS2 rules diminishing the role of state mandates, or does it enhance it, or is there even a role for state fuel requirements anymore? We have four obligated parties on the stage here, and I'd kind of like to hear their opinions on that. And I'm going to start with Dave. Dave's kind of the biggest party there.
You know, when we look at that, you say a state mandate kind of creates an island, but it also puts everyone on the same level playing field. And so initially, our position is, you know, no mandates, no subsidies, let markets dictate the products. But in an emerging technology and an emerging commodity like this, you may need these things. And really what it does is, you know, in certain markets, there's a lot of petroleum terminals that seem to be lumped together. And I'll give you a Charlotte, for example, North Carolina. There's 12 to 13 light products terminals in that marketplace. And if only one terminal or two terminals in that market puts biodiesel in it, if your customers don't want product and you've put the biodiesel in, they have opportunities to go elsewhere. So how do I recoup my capital that I put in there? And if my bio costs a little bit more than distillate, how do I recoup that cost? Well, in a state-mandated market, everybody in that terminal group is going to be making some kind of investment, so you're all on the same level playing field trying to move a product. So one of the things the state mandates do is level out the playing field inside that state, but now you have border issues because outside of that state line, now you have an issue because a terminal may be sitting inside the mandated state, but a majority of its market is outside of that state. So there's still some issues either way with that.
John?
Yeah, I think the state mandates for us enables and guides us a bit as to where to build additional infrastructure. I think that's how we look at it at Morgan. You know, with the federal RFS and our sort of initial footprint being in the Northeast, that's a great fit with RFS in that blending into heating oil, you're able to capture the value of the RIN. Moving away from that region, though, I think we will probably look for the state mandates to guide us as to where the next logical locations to build out and put that CapEx towards blending infrastructure.
Mike, what are you seeing?
I've always thought that the state mandates and or incentives at the state level really help push the product into the market. We're very comfortable that there'll be supply this year. It's just more about where's the demand and how do we get it into the market.
Which kind of brings us to another little flip side of that question. If you've got an area with a high degree of infrastructure, and I'm just going to pick on Minnesota where almost all terminals offer biodiesel blending and maybe up in the Northeast and wherever it may be, a terminal may be. Do you see those things becoming biodiesel fountains? In other words, marketers or suppliers there are going to have high biodiesel blend levels in order to generate a lot of RINs there versus somewhere where there isn't infrastructure. Is that a logical conclusion? And Dave, you've got another, I mean, you're kind of heavy into that.
Well, again, if you look at those, I mean, right now, Minnesota and Illinois are the two large, you know, for us, biodiesel markets. Minnesota, the mandate, and Illinois, the incentives. We see most of our sales as B11 out of Minnesota. in Illinois, as a customer demand. And so kind of a driver is, as that incentives have been out there, the customers want it. There's not a lot of markets above B11, so, you know, you do cap out. Do you go above B5 in Minnesota? It's a customer demand issue, but the infrastructure's there. At these terminals, we've actually put the infrastructure in to go to a B20, to go to, you know, to levels. So, yes, it could happen, but it's a customer demand.
Do you think customers will require? I mean, if I'm a Ron Marr supplier, Ron Marr Oil Company, and my supplier's Dave's Big Oil, and I don't mean that to pick on you, do you think Dave will require me to use a higher blend level just to get the RINs?
I would say at this time, no, because what I'm looking at is also a warranty of vehicles. So you start to lay everything out. I think we'll go to the levels of the mandates. What I think you'll see is instead of, you know, I think the biodiesel mandate's about 2% across the board in all the distillate pool, maybe a little less than that, but I think instead of seeing B2s, you'll see B5s. In markets. You know, I'm not going to make an infrastructure investment at every terminal and put B2 in. I'm going to make them at certain terminals and go to B5.
So if the customer wants a B20, it's available on the menu?
It could be available on the menu.
And if in each one of these markets, Ron, you got to be competitive.
Correct.
And you
got to
be economic. Correct. And as obligated parties and or people that are selling the biodiesel or the blends, we got to be able to compete with the other terminaling companies.
Correct.
That may or may not have the biodiesel. And if RINs help you do that, then that's a great short.
From your guys' chairs, do you see with the finalization of RFS2 rules and kind of the intrinsic part of those things, I mean, they can kind of become confusing. Do you see the obligated parties complying with RFS2 requirements, or do you think we'll continue to see lawsuits trying to get around it or other loopholes? Kind of a loaded question.
I personally... I think that every obligated party is going to be compliant.
Absolutely.
I don't know too many people that are going to run that risk of being out of compliance with their auditors or their shareholders. I think they'll try to be as creative as they can to maximize their RVO and their dollar spend of the cost of compliance, but I don't know of anybody that is going to risk that.
I'd say, Ron, when we look at it right now, and when we sit down and look at our strategy for biodiesel, ethanol, cellulosic, all four of those buckets that we have to comply in. I would tell you that, you know, probably a quote from one of my favorite movies, Apollo 13, failure's not an option. And it's true because our officers sign off every year that we have complied with the law. And these are the laws that we have to operate our business with. So, again, failure is not an option. When we sit down and look at our strategies, again, Mike's right, we're going to look at every different option we have, whether it's buying RINs, the wet gallon, you know, every opportunity that we have, we will look at to maximize our efficiency inside that RIN model.
Speaking of RINs, what's been your biggest challenge with the whole RIN system? Has it been the EMTS? Has it been getting them? Has it been tracking them? Or?
Well, I would, if I may, go back to the last question again before I jump on that one. But the Dave's right on target. And so is Mike. As a publicly traded company, we'll comply with the law, period. There's no gray area. It's a black or white issue. And we're not aware of anyone that's planning to use some sort of a fine, an EPA fine, as a part of their compliance strategy. Now, in regards to the implementation of the RIN program, you know, we've had time to understand it. Many other obligated parties understand it and understand the complications of the nesting relationships among the four buckets. And so it works. There are challenges to become aware of your RVO and where you stand with each bucket, but once those complications are worked through, then it's a workable program.
I think EMTS is, as it's set up or designed, should make things efficient. I think it also should certainly help in some of the administrative components in terms of duplication of RINs. But John and I were talking backstage. I think there should be a concern for everybody of some counterparty risk on the validity of RINs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a concern in our shop for sure. I know every obligated party has concerns over the validity of RINs, and hopefully EMTS will help support that validation.
Good. We got a few questions, but I got one other question here I want to address. We got about 5, 6, 7 minutes left here. This is kind of a loaded question. I kind of like loaded questions, but
John likes them too.
John likes them too.
He likes to answer them.
You know, we're looking at commodity prices, cotton prices, and people are wondering what the heck's cotton got to do with anything. But cotton prices right now are trading probably at all-time highs. Sugar prices are at record high prices. You know, most of the grains are trading at all-time record highs, or at least as high as they were. We've seen Brent crude hit the $100 mark first time in a couple of years. Biodiesel plays in the commodity market. It's an energy. It's an energy product. All that taken, what's going on in the commodity markets, what do you think is going to happen in 2011, biodiesel market-wise?
Well, I'd say most from the trading front are fairly bullish, both on the ag and the energy side. And, you know, I think that kind of feeds back into the RIN piece, and that, you know, the EMTS, I think, is a great step, but I think it's also probably a system that's going to have to evolve to be able to manage a commodity that's trading currently in the 90-cent range and could be poised to trade higher. You know, if you look at the disparity between a biodiesel RIN value and an ethanol RIN value, you know, it's certainly now a commodity at 90 cents. And I think that, you know, in general, we're seeing that the prices head north, and that RIN component is going to be a big piece of the puzzle.
This is a good question from the audience. What should the EPA and NBB doing about the prevalence of invalid RINs in the marketplace? And has EMTS cleaned any of that up, do you think?
I think yes. I'll let Mike chime in as well on this. But I think to some extent we have a situation which it's somewhat of a self-policing market right now. And those that are in the RIN market day to day and the really stakeholders of that biodiesel RIN market are going to have to work with the guidelines and what the EPA has implemented and just, as I said, sort of police the market a bit as it begins to evolve and take shape.
Mike, have you seen a lot of bad RINs floating?
I think that's the problem, is you don't know if they're bad. EMTS certainly can weed out the duplication, but you don't know if they're bad because I use the analogy, it's like musical chairs. When the music stops, somebody's going to be potentially left without a RIN or with a RIN that's valid or not. And yeah, I don't know that this market and or the counterparties are set up for that or developed.
To be quite honest, I get a call every now and then if this is our RIN. Well, yeah, it's our RIN, but I don't know if it's really my RIN. It's got my numbers on it, but how do I know if it's really my RIN?
It's like we've talked about, counterparty risk is important.
Yeah. And I think the market, we've already seen examples of people in the market stepping up, and a few whistles have been blown along the way already.
Typically in the petroleum industry, it's been my experience, if you negate an agreement, your reputation gets out pretty quick and your trading is pretty limited from that point on. So it's kind of a self-cleaning market if a trade goes bad.
Well, and John mentioned biodiesel RINs are not cheap.
No, they're not.
And they usually trade anywhere from 250 to multiple million, and you know, at upwards of closer to a penny. It's a big trade, and it's big exposure.
Question for our two pipeliners: is it not possible to simply buffer biodiesel blends to mitigate the trailback issue? And I think you kind of touched on that, but I think it's important to remember there's no physical barrier between a biodiesel blend and what follows behind it. And it's my analogy is you ship two pieces of ice, green and red, up the pipeline, and the interface melts, and you have red-green. Is there anything you can do about it? I mean, it's
Jim, would you like to start? No,
yeah. Well,
in 30 seconds or less.
That's right, in 30 seconds or less.
we've
done testing on this, and that really the idea is it's in parts per million that they test to see how much is left behind. And if anything is left behind, then you're just not allowed to do it. You can't move the two products. So we're not pursuing any movements of biodiesel in pipelines that have jet in it. That's why each one of the movements that we're doing, we move a blended product, either a B2 or a B5, and it's in a pipeline that does not have jet fuel, and that's really the only option that we're pursuing now until the rules change on this and we get different directives.
No, I would agree wholeheartedly, and we do have a lot of jet fuel that moves on the Magellan system, particularly in the Midwest, and we serve a number of large airports, and the transportation of jet fuel and the quality of jet fuel is extremely important to our overall economy. So this is a very important issue, and one that we hope is addressed sometime in the near future.
From your perspective, you sure don't want to have a jet fuel problem at 36,000 feet and it came from your system.
No, and again, adhering to all laws and regulations, we won't contaminate jet fuel.
Ron, well, to that, I think if you look at how products are put in the system, I think you're really talking about, can you sequence your pipeline? You know, again, we, Marathon, have a lot of pipeline as well. And can you sequence your batches to go in and say, I only have jet fuel following, you know, lead-free type thing? The problem is most of these pipelines are fungible systems. So I may put a batch in and it's planned to go to facility X, but on its route, somebody else needs that product and it's pulled out and moved through. So all of a sudden, your buffer's gone. So as well as you can schedule that pipeline, things change because it is a fungible system that the industry works off of. And if you take that fungibility out of it, now you've really put a constraint on all of the pipelines throughout the country.
And another point on pipelines, let's just say that jet fuel spec has changed and you can put it in the pipeline. These pipelines run across multiple states. Each state may have its own labeling requirements, may have its own spec as it relates to biofuel blends. So getting it in the pipe is the first step, but there's still some other work that needs to be done as we go cross-country with some of these blends.
And that's an interesting point, Mike, because there are two buckets here. There's a technical side and then there's a commercial side. And the commercial piece of it is one to where who owns the blend, the RINs, who's the blender. And there are a lot of different commercial factors that have to be sorted out as biodiesel moves towards the pipeline system. So that's an equal set of challenges that we'll be addressing as well. It's almost like E15 and moving from 10% ethanol into 15% ethanol. There's a technical side of it, and then there's a commercial side of it, which includes many factors in both buckets.
We got 45 seconds left. Last question from the audience, and we can just go bang, 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 bang. What percent market growth are you looking for in 2011 for biodiesel? Start at the end, off the top of your head.
100.
Dave?
Growth-wise, look and say, you know, last year what our demand was, not really our demand, but what our requirements were and what our requirements are this year, and it's probably close to about 100% increase as well.
We're hoping that we have a robust demand for biodiesel this year. We're in a position to where Jim used the words fully committed earlier, and that means fully committed to spend capital for infrastructure investment. And we hope some of that develops this year through terminal blending systems.
Guess what, guys? We're out of time, so I got two off the hook. It's been fun. I don't know if we'll do this again, I think Orlando next year, but thanks for your time.